politics or economic theory is that when each one of us is cut, our blood flows red. Mine does, and yours does too. Those who would try to appropriate God or family or country for their own narrow ends, who believe that religious faith is the property of one particular ideology, forget the width of God's embrace, the healing power of a family's arms, and the generosity of this country's vision. God, family, and nation belong to us all. And they belong to us all because of all that we share as human beings, the wonder that we experience when we look at the night sky, the gratitude that we know when we feel the heat of the sun, the sense of humor in the face of the unbearable and the persistence of suffering. And one more thing, the capacity to reach across our difference to offer a hand of healing. In 1958, my father wrote a letter to a friend whose son had died. 14 years earlier, my oldest brother Joe had been killed in World War II. 10 years earlier, my oldest sister Kathleen had been killed in an airplane crash in Europe. My father wrote to his grieving friend, "There are no words to dispel your feelings at this time, and there is no time that will ever dispel them. Nor is it any easier the second time than it was the first. And yet, I cannot share your grief, because no one could share mine. When one of your children goes out of your life, you think of what he might have done with a few more years, and you wonder what you are going to do with the rest of yours. Then one day, because there is a world to be lived in, you find yourself a part of it again, trying to accomplish something that he did not have time enough to do. And perhaps that is the reason for it all. I hope so. I wish that life were simpler. I wish that loved ones didn't have to die too young. I wish that tragedy never haunted a single soul. But to wish all that is to ask for an end to our humanity. God, family, and country sustain us all." Legend has it that in the ancient world, a poetry contest was held each year. The third place winner received a rose made of silver. The second place winner received a rose made out of gold. But the first place winner received a real rose, a beautiful living rose that soon wilted, dried up, and died. I ask you, is there a single one among us who would not choose the living rose? Chapter 25. Senator, 2000 to 2008. In 1947, shortly after Jack was sworn into Congress for the first time, he gave me a tour of Capitol Hill. I was nearly 15, and right then was when I first felt a physical love of the place. The columns and corridors and canvases. At the end of the tour, Jack gave me advice that has stayed with me to this day. "You've just seen all the buildings that symbolize what is important about this country. But remember that it isn't just the buildings. It's what happens inside the buildings that matters." To say that I love the Senate does not begin to convey what that institution means to me. Let me put it this way. After nearly half a century, I still cannot be in a car, headed for the Capitol, especially in the evening, and glimpse it in the distance without the hair standing up on my arms. I've told Vicky, if ever that sight does not move me, I will know it is time to step aside. That building symbolizes to me the benevolent power and the majesty of our government. It is awesome to me. Not awesome in the reflexive way that young people use the word, but in its real sense, its older sense, as evoking reverence. Being a senator changes a person. Something fundamental and profound happens to you when you arrive there, and it stays with you all the time that you are privileged to serve. I have seen the changes in people who have come into the Senate. It may take a year or 2 years or 3 years, but it always happens. It fills you with a heightened sense of purpose. I'm not alone in those sentiments. I remember visiting Senator Russell Long in his cavernous office shortly after I heard he planned to retire. Like me, he had become a senator at age 30, and he represented Louisiana for 39 years. He told me that he had counted on his cousin Congressman Gillis Long to tell him when to quit, because he'd seen other senators who had hung on too long. But Gillis was dead, so he had decided on his own. "Well, Russell," I said, "a few hours ago one of the real pillars that hold up that building over there disappeared from underneath the structure." "Kennedy," he responded, "let me tell you how long it will take for another pillar to spring right up. Doesn't take long with these younger fellows," he added. "Once in a while around here, you do something that you believe in." "That's right." For Long, it was supporting the Panama Canal Treaty against strong opposition. That desire to do the right thing, to serve the national interest, is inspired by the surroundings. I've studied the great architecture of government buildings and memorials in France, in Germany, in Great Britain, and other nations. Our capital is unique in the world in its design. It is a presence at once historic and alive in the moment. As a senator, you move past the impact of the building itself, but you never move very far past it. You cannot go from one room to another, and there are so many rooms, without expecting to see something new or different, even in the familiar. Take the paintings, for example, the magnificent paintings. I paint a little myself, as I've mentioned, and so perhaps I am more moved and humbled by their richness. I think of those big, sweeping, elegant canvases of John Trumbull that hang in the rotunda, Declaration of Independence, Surrender of General Burgoyne, Surrender of Lord Cornwallis, and General George Washington resigning his commission. Trumbull was a Harvard man and an aide to Washington in the Revolutionary War. He witnessed the Battle of Bunker Hill. Those oils are the most dramatic paintings in the Capitol. They have hung there since 1826. And of course there are those towering murals and frescoes and portraits by Constantino Brumidi. Brumidi was Italian, but when he arrived in the United States in 1852 at age 47, he made himself one of us by declaring, "My ambition and my daily prayer is that I may live long enough to make beautiful the capital of the one country on earth in which there is liberty." Which he did, over 27 years of constant work. His fresco, Apotheosis of George Washington, graces the rotunda along with the Trumbulls, and his paintings flow through many rooms and hallways, most notably the famous Brumidi Corridor. Even the Senate desks hold great meaning. A lot of these mahogany desks, 48 of them, I believe, date to 1819. The Senate bought them that year as part of the restoration after the British set the Capitol afire during the War of 1812. My desk is the one that Jack sat in when he was in the Senate. Barack Obama sat in Bobby's old desk when he was a senator. Daniel Webster's old desk is always reserved for the senior senator from New Hampshire, Webster's native state. Then there's the tradition of scratching our names into the wood on the bottoms of our desk drawers to chronicle which senator held which desk down through the years. This custom dates only to the early 1900s. Jack did this, and I did it, and Bobby did it. Finally, we have the tradition of the candy desk. In the late 1960s, Senator George Murphy of California had a desk on the back row on the Republican side of the chamber. We all knew that George had a sweet tooth and kept candy in his desk drawer. Senators had to pass by his desk to walk on and off the floor, and would often reach into his desk drawer for candy. It quickly became a tradition that whoever occupied that desk inherited the responsibility of keeping its drawer well stocked with candy. As I write this, Senator Mel Martinez of Florida sits at the candy desk and maintains its supply of sweets. Sometime later, Democratic senators began their own candy desk tradition. It's the Democratic Secretary's Desk, a beautiful old roll-top desk in a corner of the Senate chamber. Senators contribute to a candy fund to keep that desk supplied, too. I love spending time in the Russell Senate Office Building, known before 1972 as the Old Senate Office Building. It's a fine old Beaux-Arts structure that was finished in 1908. Being inside it gives you a marvelous sense of closeness to its history. You walk into that old building, and it takes your breath away. You stand up straighter. The architecture is such that you can speak in its rotunda and hear your voice echoing back perfectly. In fact, in the Senate chamber, even if you haven't got a booming voice, you can still be heard just about all through that building. Senators and their families used to have picnics on the grounds back in the 1960s and 70s. A number of us had young children at that time, and we'd sit out on the lawn with them and enjoy the evening. There's a lantern atop the dome of the Capitol that stays lit as long as either the House or Senate are in session. Also, the American flag stays raised over the Senate chamber as long as the Senate is in session. So we could always tell when the Senate was meeting. And there's a system of lights and bells throughout the Senate complex that told us what was happening on the floor at that moment. One light or one bell meant a vote was starting. Five lights or five bells told us that vote was ending soon and we'd better hurry over to cast our votes. Two lights or two bells were a quorum call, which meant that we could safely continue picnicking with our families. We would leave the windows of the Russell Building open during our picnics, so that we were sure to hear the bells and know when we needed to run off to a vote. It was a friendly, welcoming place back then, the Senate. That has not been lost, the sense that it is the people's building. In my early years in the Senate, there were not nearly the number of votes that we have now. When the weather was good, the old bulls, the senior members who wielded all the power, would spend their mornings at the Congressional Country Club in Bethesda playing golf. They'd return to their offices around noon, just in time for lunch in the Senate dining room. After that, they would sign their mail, perhaps make a speech on the Senate floor, and by then it was time to gather for a little drink in some senator's office. Then they'd spend their evenings at various social events. The events that changed all that were the Civil Rights era and the Vietnam War, both in the mid-1960s. This time marked the resurgence of the filibuster and also of the five-day work week. The Senate was suddenly in session virtually 12 months a year, with only the 4th of July, Labor Day, and Thanksgiving off. I remember coming back to Washington to cast a vote between Christmas and New Year's when Bobby was in the Senate. And yet this constant work under extreme social pressure gave the Senate a real sense of community. We were in session a good number of evenings, so everyone stayed around through the week. I can remember having my children at the office. Many senators did. In summer, the military bands used to play in front of the Senate steps on the east side of the Capitol. At intervals, senators might scurry away from outdoor family picnics and onto the floor to offer an amendment. This camaraderie in the midst of hard work helped senators to listen to one another, and sometimes even to take action on matters they might have otherwise avoided. That's missing today. Now the Senate is basically in session from Tuesday through Thursday. Colleagues speak to each other via BlackBerry and telephone. This loss of face-to-face interaction certainly isn't unique to the Senate, but I do think it's a loss. I'm a big believer in going to a colleague's office if I have something I want to discuss or a request I want to make. I want to read their face, interact, laugh. 95% of the nitty-gritty work of drafting and even negotiating is now done by staff. That alone marks an enormous shift of responsibility over the past 40 or 50 years. We have an extraordinarily capable, committed, and professional staff, themselves tremendous public servants. Most senators do. And we couldn't tackle the myriad issues without their essential work. But we walk a fine line. As senators, We need to be vigilant that we don't lose track of the whole essence of what the Senate is, of what our involvement in it signifies, of our relationship with people, and of what all of that should lead to, which is the unfettered and vital exchange of ideas. I think of the withering away of collegiality and sense of collective mission as the corruption of the Senate. I don't mean corruption in a legal sense. Rather, I mean corruption in the sense that things are broken. This breakdown has been driven primarily by two factors. First, there are forces that actually do not want the Senate to meet and be active in the affairs of the nation. If the Senate is not active, legislation slows down, we don't deal with the hard issues because dealing with them suggests change. And second, is the distorted influence of money and the power of vested interests in the legislative process. I don't think any unbiased observer can deny that the way campaigns are financed has an unhealthy influence on the legislative process. I was an early supporter of public financing for House and Senate campaigns, as well as presidential campaigns, but that isn't going to happen in my lifetime. Perhaps the advent of internet fundraising, which was so successful in President Obama's election, will undercut the disproportionate impact of money on the legislative process. I was naturally dismayed by the ambiguities of the 2000 election and disturbed by the Supreme Court's role and decision-making process in it. But I applauded Al Gore's grace and civility in handling the outcome and prepared myself to deal with the realities. Alan Simpson, who'd been a political adversary and personal friend of mine when he was a Republican senator from Wyoming, assured me that George W. Bush was a fellow I could work with. His word counted, and he told the new president the same thing about me. I took Al at his word, which I always knew I could count on. Our first social invitation from the new president and first lady was to a screening of 13 Days, the new movie about the Cuban Missile Crisis that starred Kevin Costner as Jack's aide, Kenny O'Donnell. The screening was held on Thursday night, February 1, 2001, the day the Senate voted to confirm John Ashcroft as Attorney General by a vote of 58-42. I recognized this invitation as a gesture of respect and goodwill from the president and took it as a harbinger of cooperation in the months ahead. In that spirit, Vicky and I arrived at the White House with a gift to the Bushes, a framed version of the history of President Kennedy's desk. On my first meeting with Bush in the Oval Office a week or so earlier, he'd pointed out to me that he had chosen the desk Jack used in the Oval Office. When the President and First Lady came down the stairs, I greeted him and said, "Congratulations on your day." He shot me a cool glance. I guess that I couldn't blame him much. I'd been vocal in my opposition to the confirmation of John Ashcroft as Attorney General, and in the debate that preceded the vote earlier in the day, I'd repeated my charge that the nominee had used litigation and legislation in creative and inappropriate ways to advance his ideological goals. How could we have any confidence, I'd asked, that Ashcroft wouldn't do the same thing as Attorney General? I had not thought that this exceeded the bounds of legitimate debate, and I'd assumed the president would not take it personally. He did not. He introduced Vicky and me to the First Lady, and we quickly found an upbeat topic, the quality of the singing at the prayer breakfast that morning. The East Room was quickly filling up with other guests. We repaired to the buffet for a distinctive dinner of hamburgers, hot dogs, and chili, and then we filed in for the screening. Vicky and I were invited to sit in the front row next to the Bushes. I could tell that the president loved the movie. He was amused that the film didn't show Lyndon Johnson in any of the critical meetings on the crisis, and got a great kick out of the portrayal of Bobby, who was depicted as always rasping about straightening somebody out or kicking tail or loyalty. We were out of there by 9:40. President Bush had signaled a willingness to tackle education reform, and I was certainly willing to work together to find agreement on something that would make a difference. He called his effort No Child Left Behind. Republicans controlled the Senate and the House, and I was the ranking Democratic member of the Senate Health, Education, and Labor Committee, of which Jim Jeffords of Vermont was the chairman. I was pleased that the president was interested in education reform and assumed that time would tell just how serious he was. But in the meantime, I felt it imperative to keep the lines of communication with the White House open. One reason was the opportunity to keep the federal government involved in education. Abolishing the Department of Education had been a popular cause among some Republicans, who preferred to see school policy reside entirely within the individual states. But some states are wealthier than others, and some are more under the sway of extra educational forces that can affect the quality of learning. But I believe that federal resources could be effectively used as a helping hand in areas where there is an obvious need, as a partner, not a competitor, in improving education. The other reason is that we were elected to do something. And politics aside, if we had a shot at education reform, especially with a Republican president and a Republican Senate and Republican House, well, I was going to try to seize it. Several months of negotiation, frustration, and compromise led at last to the passage of No Child Left Behind late in 2001. Flawed but necessary, No Child was itself a child of bipartisanship. My faith in No Child Left Behind was bolstered by the evaluation of Bush's blueprint by my counterpart in the House, George Miller of California. Miller was the new ranking Democrat on the House Education and Labor Committee. He was a powerhouse on many progressive issues, education foremost among them. He'd been impressed with Bush's grasp of educational matters. Miller and I would work closely together in crafting the No Child concept into legislation, along with two Republicans, Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire and Congressman John Boehner of Ohio. No Child Left Behind was to be the title for Bush's proposed $46.7 billion reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, a leading feature of Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty back in 1965. It had been set to expire in 1970, but had been reauthorized by Congress approximately every 5 years since. Partisan fighting in Congress had stunted the Education Act's effectiveness for many years, with Republicans demanding more emphasis on block grants and voucher programs, and Democrats pushing for reduced class size and teacher training. Its scheduled reauthorization in 1999 to 2000 was in fact lost in the ideological sparring of the presidential campaign. The annual expenditure for Bush's plan was budgeted at $17.4 billion. Its tools of reform were to be standards and accountability, with a high emphasis on testing, and with the federal government taking the dominant role in measuring the results. I had spent a good deal of time familiarizing myself with testing measures, and I found this approach full of promise. Accordingly, I expressed great public enthusiasm at the outset. I complimented Bush's personality and his intelligence. I emphasized to the press the areas in which Republicans and Democrats generally agreed on No Child, and I downplayed such thorny issues as the vouchers question. By early April, things were looking rather good. Enough compromise had been achieved that Senate debate on the bill could move forward. The Democrats agreed to use federal funds for private tutoring of students at failing schools, and Republicans let go of the push for vouchers, at least for the time being. Our side even consented to a trial block grant program involving 7 states. To the consternation of some of my Senate colleagues, I announced substantial progress to the press and praised President Bush for keeping education reform as his top priority. Full Senate debate on No Child began in May and continued for a rigorous and exhausting 6 weeks. Bipartisanship ruled the day in the early going. My Democratic colleagues and I were pleased to see several important agreements and concessions from the administration side. targeting resources to children in the neediest schools, increased support for teachers, and stronger parent involvement in schools. These and other progressive measures were authorized in the bill that finally emerged. That was the good news. But, as with all bills of this nature, we would still need the necessary appropriation of funds from the Congress. The President never fought for the funds he promised. When the Republican-controlled Congress announced its budget resolution in early May, appropriations for No Child Left Behind fell far short of what we needed. I was angry and said so. Yet my thoughts were focused not on accepting defeat, but on finding ways to keep success within reach. I announced my hope of opening up funding by attacking the huge tax cuts then being debated in Congress and by getting more money into the Labor, Health, and Human Services Appropriations Bill that was also headed for a vote. My party had been adapting itself to survival without institutional power since the 2000 elections. But on May 24th, an act of unusual political courage abruptly ended that situation. The Republican Jim Jeffords of Vermont announced that he was ending his affiliation with his party. The precipitating event was the President's and the Republican Party's lack of commitment to special education funding in the budget. Jeffords would become an independent, but would caucus from now on with the Democrats. Jeffords' decision had several immediate effects. It gave Democrats a de facto 51-seat majority. It turned over committee chairmanships to Democrats, unseated Trent Lott as majority leader in favor of Tom Daschle, and on June 6th, restored me to chairmanship of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. On June 14th, the Senate passed the bill to reauthorize the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, with 91 senators voting in favor. I was enormously heartened. I had done everything in my power to keep people from both parties together on this. I understood the apprehension of some on my side. What is absolutely essential, I pointedly told the press, is having the kind of funding levels to make sure children who need extra help get it. For now, what mattered to me was that education reform was still alive. The bill now would head for a conference committee that would try to bring it and the House's bill into alignment. Improving its weaker elements and fighting for funding, I believed, could be tackled once it became law. Bush called for Congress to send him a bill to sign before recessing in early August. Easier said than done. George Miller and I, leading the Democrats, worked hard to find common ground with the Republicans, John Boehner and Judd Gregg, but we stalled on several issues. July and August passed without an agreement. On the morning of September 11th, 2001, I sat in my Senate office with Senator Gregg, awaiting the arrival of Laura Bush, whom we were to escort across the hall to her testimony before our committee on the subject of early education. I had brought a painting of mine to give her as a memento. The First Lady's husband was at an elementary school in Sarasota, Florida, reading to a class of young pupils as part of his tour to publicize his administration's commitment to education reform. I was waiting for Mrs. Bush when someone from my office came to tell me that Vicky had just called. An airplane had crashed into one of the World Trade Center towers in New York. At this point, reports were that it was likely a small plane that veered off course, but Vicky raised the specter of terrorism. I found the news bizarre, grotesque. Judd Gregg felt the same way. A few minutes later, Vicky called again. Aware now that something cataclysmic and deliberate had happened to the nation, we saw Mrs. Bush perhaps 75 yards down the corridor, walking toward me in front of her Secret Service detail. The rest of that day is part of the nation's history. Mrs. Bush, Judd Gregg, and I announced that we would postpone our hearing, but that we would not be defeated by terrorism. Senator Gregg and I then spent the next couple of hours on Capitol Hill with Mrs. Bush. We kept the television set off and simply talked for a while. I will always remember her composure and elegance, qualities that she drew upon in the hours that followed to help comfort a nation in shock. A sense of patriotism and shared responsibility took hold in all of us. Getting the education bill enacted into law had become both an affirmation of America's values and a demonstration to all countries that this Congress would not allow terrorism to cripple its ability to continue the nation's essential work. Huge differences remained, however, and as talks progressed through the fall, they centered more and more on the cost of the reforms. Those crafting the appropriations bill for 2002 had floated a figure of $4 billion in discretionary spending increases for education. That was far too little to do what needed to be done. I called for twice that amount, and House conservatives revealed their own preferred level of expenditure increases. None whatsoever. Exhaustive negotiations regarding testing requirements and funding provisions, and many other issues, continued for almost 2 months among designated members in the House and Senate. Finally, on December 12, 2001, we agreed on the specifics of the legislation. It was the only bipartisan measure of any scope passed in that year. The following January, President Bush signed No Child Left Behind into law. In several important ways, the Democrats had scored a major victory. Our negotiations had produced an appropriations agreement of $22.6 billion for education in fiscal 2002, a gigantic increase over Bush's original goal of just $685 million increase over the previous year's $17.4 billion. And we had retained many of the policy principles that we considered essential from the start. My remarks as the bill became law were conciliatory. "This is the president's signature issue," I said. "He can claim a big victory, but so can we, as well as the children." I genuinely believe this. No Child, as I saw it then, was the most significant advance in public education of the past quarter century. In other important ways, however, our victory rested on shaky ground. Though the $22.6 billion represented a 20% increase over the previous education budget, Miller and I believe that it was still not enough to fulfill the standards that the Act itself required. That worry became sadly moot a few weeks later when President Bush sent his new budget to Congress. It included none of the new money he had promised us. He blamed the cost of the military strike in Afghanistan, seeking the terrorists responsible for the 9/11 attacks for the need to trim back. No Child has struggled on through the ensuing years, effective in some ways, but never the transformative tool that it could have been. Underfunded, mismanaged, and poorly implemented, as I put it, a spectacular broken promise of the Republican administration and Congress. I added that America's children deserved better. All of America's people deserved better than the misuse of U.S. power in Iraq, as did the Iraqi people. The war's effects are still fresh as I write these words, and so I will attempt no detailed retelling of them here. Looking over my personal journals and the many speeches and briefing memos in my files, I am struck once again at how clear the march to disaster seemed to me at the time, and how brazenly the administration's justifications departed from reality. That march began in the glow of American support for President Bush immediately following the September 11th attacks by Al-Qaeda and for his sending troops to Afghanistan to hunt down the terrorists responsible. The president and his men lost no time exploiting that trust and goodwill. In what I have called an extraordinary policy coup, led by Vice President Cheney, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, and Rumsfeld's deputy Paul Wolfowitz, the administration succeeded in changing the subject to Iraq. I had met Vice President Cheney years before, when he was a congressman, through our mutual friend Alan Simpson, who, like Cheney, was from Wyoming. Cheney seemed agreeable to me at first, affable and smart, even though we had different political views. His votes were ultra-conservative. Maybe we just didn't notice how extreme he was because his positions didn't carry the day. But when he became vice president, he had the power, but he lacked the good judgment to see beyond those extreme views. I withheld my final judgment on the prudence of the Iraq War until I went back to the Senate in September 2002. There are no more important votes that a senator makes than on issues of war and peace, and I wanted to understand the issue fully before reaching a final decision. As a member of the Armed Services Committee, I listened carefully to the testimony of the witnesses. I was struck by the consistent drumbeat of opposition to the rush to war by respected military leaders. General John Chalikasvili, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Wesley Clark, former Supreme Allied Commander, Europe, Marine General Joseph Hoare, former Commander-in-Chief of Central Command. I will never forget what General Hoare in particular said in response to my question about urban warfare. He said that Baghdad would look like the last 15 minutes of the Spielberg movie Saving Private Ryan. My views on war drew upon the teachings of St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas. A distillation of their philosophies has yielded six principles that guide the determination of a just war, and these principles were my guiding arguments. A war must have a just cause, confronting a danger that is beyond question. It must be declared by a legitimate authority acting on behalf of the people. It must be driven by the right intention, not ulterior, self-interested motives. It must be a last resort. It must be proportional, so that the harm inflicted does not outweigh the good achieved, and it must have a reasonable chance of success. There was no just cause for the invasion of Iraq, I declared time and again. Iraq posed no threat that justified immediate preemptive war, and there was no convincing pattern of relationships between Saddam and Al-Qaeda. The legitimate authority, the Congress, indeed approved authorization for the use of force in Iraq in October 2002, but it acted in haste and under pressure from the White House, which intentionally politicized the vote by scheduling it before midterm elections. By contrast, in 1991, the administration of the first President Bush timed the vote on the use of military force against Iraq to occur after midterm elections in order to depoliticize the decision. As for motives, those stated by the Bush administration itself were unacceptable on their face. The Bush administration says we must take preemptive action against Iraq, I pointed out from the Senate floor in October 2002. But what the administration is really calling for is preemptive war, which flies in the face of international rules of acceptable behavior. I was far blunter less than 2 years later, when the loss of life by our young troops and the devastation to Iraqi society had grown grotesque. The war, I charged on the Senate floor in July 2004, was a fraud cooked up in Texas to advance the president's political standing. I said that the administration had told lie after lie after lie after lie to trigger and perpetuate one of the worst blunders in the history of U.S. foreign policy. The war failed the last resort principle for reasons too obvious to dwell on here. On the question of proportionality, did the harm inflicted outweigh the good achieved? I pointed out again to the loss of American and Iraqi lives, the collapse of Iraqi civil society, the self-fulfilling prophecy of terrorists flooding into the ravaged country and using it as a base, the heightened tensions with the entire Islamic world, and our loss of international prestige generally. As for a reasonable question of success, there was never a question that we would win the military phase of the Iraq War. The more significant success, ending terrorism, promoting regional stability, sustaining America's reputation as a just nation and a model for enlightenment, has yet to be achieved. I'd first met John Kerry in the spring of 1971, when the Vietnam veterans protesting the war were bivouacked on the Mall in Washington. I was impressed by the forcefulness of this young man with a long, serious face and the great mop of dark hair as he articulated the case against the war, and also by his record of courage in combat. I wasn't surprised when John decided to enter politics, and I campaigned for him in his first effort, a losing bid for Congress in 1972. He was elected lieutenant governor under Michael Dukakis 10 years later, and in 1984 won election to the Senate, taking the seat of Paul Tsongas, who'd retired. He and I voted together on nearly all the issues. I have enormous respect for John Kerry. He is not only my colleague, he is my friend. When John decided to run for president, I was convinced that a John Kerry presidency would be good for the country. He has courage and strength of character and a strong grasp of foreign policy. He is a certifiable, decorated war hero. I also knew that with Kerry in the White House, we would be able to advance health care for all Americans. I enthusiastically signed on to his team. But in 2003, John's campaign was faltering. I noticed a sluggishness when I campaigned with him in Iowa. Howard Dean of Vermont was coming on strong as a fresh face. His passion and his fearless stance against the Iraq War were galvanizing Democrats. And he was amassing more money than John with his pioneering use of the Internet as a fundraising tool. By late September, John's Boston and Washington advisors were at loggerheads, creating divisions that distracted from his campaign. My own chief of staff, the highly competent Mary Beth Cahill, joined him as campaign manager. A new energy soon swept through the Kerry ranks. When I returned to Iowa with the candidate 2 weeks before the January caucuses, I saw that he had been regenerated as well. I was seeing a new Kerry, whose speeches were shorter and punchier, and who was making a warm personal connection to the voters. I was having great fun, too, revving up the crowd, teasing them about not voting for me in '80, but saying all would be forgiven if they just voted for John. "Hello, Cedar Rapids! Are you glad to see me? Well, I'm glad to see you!" And around the state we went. Jim Rassman joined John on the trail, too, to testify to John's character and heroism. John had saved Rassman's life in Vietnam and hadn't seen him since, but the veteran found him because he wanted to share his story. Kerry won the Iowa caucuses, won New Hampshire, and rang up 9 victories on Super Tuesday to clinch the Democratic nomination in Boston. He picked John Edwards as his running mate. We conferred frequently through the early summer, strategizing on his approaches to the economy and the Iraq War. In August, not long after the Democratic convention, the so-called Swift Boat Veterans for Truth unleashed their $20 million television smear campaign against John, falsely impugning his stellar military record. They used gutterball tactics of the worst kind. John had 3 outstanding debate performances, with the first being especially impressive. Vicky and I continued to campaign hard for him until the last moment. On election morning, Vicky and I voted at the town hall in Hyannis. The lines were moderate, but we heard that earlier, around dawn, they'd been very long. I had a sense that the momentum was with John. We took a sail before noon, then traveled the 70 miles west to Providence to spend a little time with Patrick, who was headed toward an overwhelming victory in his re-election to Congress. Vicky and I spent the evening in Boston, where I did some television interviews and met with Democratic supporters. The news was reporting enormous turnouts, which all of us believed were to the Democrats' advantage, and the exit polls were showing big advantages for Kerry. "I've been proud to call John Kerry my friend," I told one group of boosters, "and I'm going to be even prouder to call him my president." The crowd went wild. And then Vicky and I headed to our Boston apartment to watch the returns. Earlier in the evening, when I was doing television interviews, I learned that the networks couldn't get prominent Republicans to respond to the early trends because they were so decisively in John's favor. The White House was in hunker-down mode. Relatives and friends wandered in and out of the apartment as the evening wore on. Projections began to appear showing Bush winning the western states, but that was predictable. The producers were trying to inject drama into a race that they knew had been decided. Not exactly. Later in the evening, we began to notice that some of the eastern states we'd expected to end up in our column were not going that way. Florida went for Bush, a disappointment, but not a surprise. But the number of states showing up as red in the graphics was a surprise. The heavy Kerry votes we'd counted on, that the exit polls had told us were there, were just not coming in. Suddenly, we noticed that Republicans were materializing on screen for live interviews. They were no longer in the bunker. The terrible awareness of a turning tide crept in. Then Bush called reporters into the White House where he was watching with his family. We tried to tell ourselves that this was just a bit of stagecraft to give the illusion that he was winning. Around 11 p.m., California came in with a big win for John. But the sea of red between California and Illinois was unbroken, and it started to become clear that the only path to a Democratic victory was through Ohio. James Carville on one of the channels was saying that John Kerry had to pull an inside straight, that it was time to recognize that this was George Bush's night, not Kerry's, unless something dramatic happened. The people in our apartment were rather distraught by James saying that. They thought perhaps it was sour grapes because he hadn't been invited to run the campaign. But I just thought he was being honest. I telephoned Tim Hagan, a friend of ours in Cleveland, who said, "Things were fine. Cuyahoga County was looking good. We think we've got Ohio. The exit polls..." The night went on and the numbers grew more disturbing. Vicky later said she'd felt the networks were not calling the election for Bush only for fear of repeating the Florida fiasco of 4 years earlier. I called Hagan again. Nick Littlefield, a top lawyer in Boston and former staff director of my committee, was there, and he talked to Hagan. Michael Myers, our friend and current committee staff director, talked to Hagan. And then I talked to Hagan again, and Tim said quietly, "I think we've lost it." Almost at the same moment, Fox News called the election for Bush. In the silence that followed, people began to leave the apartment to go home to bed. Soon Vicky and I were alone. It was well after midnight. I made a decision. "We're going to Lewisburg Square," I told my wife, "to see John and Teresa." It was a drizzly, dreary, humid, cold night in Boston, and close to 2:30 a.m. when we arrived. Gabby, the Kerry's household assistant, met us at the door and told us that John and Teresa had gone to bed. We offered to leave, but Gabby told us not to. "The senator will be upset if he knows you're here and he wasn't told." She went upstairs. A few minutes later, the defeated Democratic candidate for the presidency came down into the living room to greet us. Vicky spotted him first. "Gosh, Vicky, what a drag. This is a drag, isn't it?" he said as Vicky hugged him and said, "Boy, is it ever." I gave John a warm handshake and then an embrace. "My friend, how are you doing?" I asked him. He replied, "There are so many things I wanted to do for this country." I was deeply moved by the reaction of this war hero who had fought so hard to win the election and who had just hours earlier looked to all the world like he was going to be the next president of the United States. He wasn't bitter or angry, and he wasn't really focused on himself. He was down about the opportunities lost to move the country in a new, more progressive direction. I shared his disappointment. We had worked so hard and come so close. The re-election of President Bush meant that it would be another 4 years before there might be a great leader in the White House. In my nearly 50 years of public life, we have not had a president as successful as FDR. The closest we've come, family relations excluded, is Lyndon Johnson. Civil rights was the issue of our time. He picked up that unfinished work and ensured the passage of the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act. If he hadn't, we certainly wouldn't be where we are today. We certainly wouldn't have the president we have today. Lyndon Johnson knew how to work Congress and move things forward to achieve his goal of a great society. Tragically, the Vietnam War ended all that. Johnson got caught up in it and handled it miserably. The Cold War was at its height, and we all had reasons for believing at first that our involvement was vital. But the continued escalation was a huge blunder. It needlessly took so many lives and sucked all of the air and energy out of our progressive ideals. We lost our way. It would take time for voters to endorse those values again. I rejoice in having lived to see it happen. Chapter 26 Perseverance 2009 I have never dwelled on reversals. A defeated bill or a legislative cause that remains unrealized year after year. An election that goes the wrong way. There has been so much to be thankful for. There have been so many reasons for hope. In the early months of 2008, out of a crowded field of talented Democratic primary candidates, there emerged a young man so compelling, so electric, his mind so alive with good ideas that before I knew it, I was hopscotching around the western states for him like a fellow half my age, pumping my fist and telling wildly cheering crowds, "I smell change in the air!" I had many longtime friends among the Democratic presidential contenders. Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, Chris Dodd, John Edwards, Bill Richardson. And I had come to respect my new colleague, Barack Obama. All of these candidates were more than qualified to be president, and I would have enthusiastically supported any of them had they been the party's nominee. But I held back at first from getting involved in the primary. As I said many times, I was waiting to see who was capable of lifting up and inspiring our nation to move forward toward our highest and best ideals before I decided to endorse anyone. On the night of the Iowa caucuses, Vicky and I watched Barack Obama's victory speech and knew that he had the capacity to inspire. I was among the millions moved as well by Senator Clinton's powerful and uplifting appeal, but I came to believe that Obama was the candidate we needed now at this time in our history. As I talked with my niece Caroline, her children, and our children, I saw the impact that Obama's words were having on them. I felt more and more certain that history had handed us that rarest of figures, one who could truly carve out new frontiers. Or, as the candidate put it in a phrase that resounded everywhere, "Yes, we can." At around 8 o'clock on Thursday morning, January 24, 2008, 2 days before the critically important South Carolina primary, I spoke with Senator Obama from my home in Washington. "Listen, pal, is there room on that train of yours for an old—" I couldn't get the rest of it out before the future president's delighted laughter interrupted me, and I laughed along with him. Then I told him more seriously, "I'm really very strongly in your corner. At the beginning of this whole process, I was looking for the person who was going to inspire. That's what the country needs, and I think you've got it." The next day, Barack gained his breakout victory in South Carolina. Shortly after that, we were out campaigning like it was 1960. New Mexico, California, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, all on February 4th, the eve of Super Tuesday. Barack picked up 13 states to Hillary's 10 the next day. A day later, I saw Hillary on the Senate floor and congratulated her on her strong showing. She was smiling and laughing. Despite my endorsement of Obama, my state of Massachusetts was one of those in her win column. Barack, who was nearby, caught the mood of the moment. He came over to us and joked, "Maybe, Hillary, I should have let him endorse you." Then I spotted John Kerry and said, "Well, I'm not too good on the endorsing. I endorsed Kerry too, and look what happened to him." It was a light-hearted and lively moment, which I think the Senate sometimes shows when it's at its best. Then Vicky and I hit the trail again. Maine, Pennsylvania, Washington, Maine again, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, Ohio. Our packed schedule of flights and motorcades might have been exhausting, but we were constantly recharged by the prevailing mood of joy. The crowds were large and festive and welcoming, and they made it a pleasure for me to be back on the stump. It was fun, sheer fun. Hillary fought on with extraordinary determination and skill, and kept the outcome in doubt until the late spring. By that time, of course, I was recovering from my successful surgery at Duke Medical Center, and hoping to be well enough by August to make that appearance at the Democratic Convention in Denver. That hope came true, as did my promise to be in Washington for the inauguration of President Obama. He has the potential to be a great president. And speaking of hope, I still recall that first evening I spent after my seizure in Massachusetts General Hospital, eating chowder from Legal Seafood with Vicky and my children and watching the Red Sox game on TV. But not even someone as hopeful as I would have imagined that on April 7th, 2009, I would be standing on the mound at Fenway Park, like Honey Fitz in 1912. I was ready to throw out the first pitch on opening day. I leaned in and peered down for the sign from Hall of Famer Jim Rice, who crouched a few feet away. The first pitch fell short of the target, but I was determined, so I threw a second one and hit my mark. As I later told my grandchildren, I was going to keep throwing until I got it right. Persistence matters. As my story draws to a close, I am living with cancer, and I know that I will die with it, and likely from it. But I don't dwell on that. I have good days and not so good days. But more than a year after my diagnosis, I have not yet spent a day in bed. With Vicky's constant help and encouragement, I follow a healthy diet and continue to do moderate exercise. I look forward to going outside every day, rain or shine, to breathe fresh air. I tire more easily than before and need extra rest, and I sometimes use one word when I mean to use another. Still, I continue to sail, as much as the weather allows, and I pray. All of my life, the teachings of my faith have provided solace and hope, as have the wonders of nature, especially the sea, where religion and spirituality meet the physical. This faith has been as meaningful to me as breathing or loving my family. It's all intertwined. My faith, and the love of following its rituals, has always been my foundation and my inspiration. Those foundations have been shaken at times by tragedy and misfortune, but faith remains fixed in my heart, as it has been since my childhood days. It is the most positive force in my life and the cause of my eternal optimism. I have fallen short in my life, but my faith has always brought me home. For almost 50 years, I have represented people who are facing injustice or pain. Life can be violent and grim, but I think of the resurrection and I feel a sense of hope. When I've started down a spiral of depression or negativism or loss, I've been lucky enough to be able to see another side that can catch me on the way. I believe that if you have a warm and embracing heart, faith can have a powerful impact on your outlook. Vicky has been a great source of strength and love because we share this underlying belief and faith. Life is eternal. Work continues. It is a calling, an opportunity to do things about injustice or unfairness, It helps to have a goal. I've always tried to have one. Even this disease has proved itself an impetus for hope. In my lifetime, I have witnessed advances in medical understanding of malignancy and treatment for it that would have been unthinkable in my early years. Teddy Jr., then Kara, then myself, three hopeless victims of unusually deadly attacks, are among the millions who've enjoyed extended life thanks to these ongoing breakthroughs. Yet so much more is possible. I see how far we've come in my lifetime. When I first campaigned for Jack in the 1960 presidential primaries, Medicare didn't even exist. Now it is part of our national contract. Even in these challenging times, there are daily reasons to rejoice. After years of work, we finally passed a national service bill that will triple the size of AmeriCorps and dramatically expand opportunities for service by all Americans. And of course, my work to improve health care, the great cause of my life, will continue to my last day and beyond if, as I hope, these words inspire readers to take up the cause. One of the great lessons I've learned from a life in politics is that no reform is ever truly complete. We must constantly keep moving forward, seeking ways to create that more perfect union. In my personal life, I kept moving to avoid the tragedy behind me. As a senator, that same motivation has been a blessing. These days, simple pleasures fill me with happiness. In my 77 years, I have never grown tired of sitting on my front porch and looking out over Nantucket Sound. The waters change texture and color with the light, the weather, the seasons, the time of day. I still pass many contented hours sitting in my green cushioned wicker chair with a hot mug of tea on the table beside me, gazing at the sea, the diving osprey, the gulls that can be suspended in midair as they fly against the wind. I love the reflection of the setting sun on the wooden masts of Maya, the rising moon, the beauty of a rainbow after a storm. I am seldom far from the company of my dogs, Splash, Sunny, and now our new pup, Captain's Courageous, Cappy. They love to retrieve tennis balls, and if a ball finds its way into the water, the dogs won't be far behind. Sailing is still my favorite pastime. Being on the ocean has thrilled me and comforted me and protected me for all my life, and I love that time now, perhaps more than ever. I also take pleasure in knowing that the sea has formed a bond with our grandchildren as well. One of my favorite stories is how little Teddy in particular has developed into a sailor. I'm Big Teddy, Medium Teddy is my son, and Little Teddy is his son, Edward Moore Kennedy III, born in 1998. In the summer of 2008, 10-year-old Little Teddy spent the summer in Hyannisport, working hard on his sailing. As he told me one evening, his father passed sailing on to him just as I had passed it on to his father. It was a Kennedy tradition to sail. The problem was, though, that throughout July, nothing seemed to go right with little Teddy's sailing and he wasn't having very much fun. He would race his boat and come in last or second to last. He would swamp his boat and spend his time bailing it out. He was often miserable and shed more than a few tears. But his father and I encouraged him. Keep sailing. Try this technique. Don't give up. I told Teddy of my being eighth string on the Harvard football team and how I was not the best athlete by far, but how I stayed with it and didn't give up, and by my senior year I was a starter and caught touchdown passes. His face seemed to light up a bit. We may not be the best, Teddy, but we can work harder than anyone, I told him, and that will make the difference. Little Teddy stayed with it. He grew eager to learn. He got better, He got more than better. He started winning races. When they gave the sailing awards at the end of August, Teddy had won first place for the August series in his division. What a triumph. But what meant even more to him, and I must say, more to me, is that he won the award for the most improved sailor. It was a great moment. A grand moment. You couldn't even button up Teddy's coat because his chest was so filled with pride and achievement. This is the greatest lesson a child can learn. It is the greatest lesson anyone can learn. It has been the greatest lesson I have learned. If you persevere, stick with it, work at it, you have a real opportunity to achieve something. Sure, there will be storms along the way, and you might not reach your goal right away. But if you do your best and keep a true compass, you'll get there.
This has been an Hachette audio production of True Compass by Edward M. Kennedy, read by John Bedford Lloyd. Executive producer, Michelle McGonigal, produced by John McElroy, directed by Scott Sherritt, recorded by Ethan Donaldson, CDM Studios, New York. Post-production by CDM Studios, New York. True Compass is also available in print from 12, a division of Hachette Book Group, Incorporated. Text copyright 2009 by Edward M. Kennedy, Incorporated. Audio production copyright 2009, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this publication may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the written permission of the publisher.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.